Good evening. Welcome. It's good to be back here. I've been gone a couple weeks. I've been on a Dharma study retreat up in Washington State. Immersed in looking into the teachings of the Mahayana, a great vehicle of Buddha's teachings, the foundation of Zen practice and Tibetan Buddhist practice. And there's a lot that I could say about many things I've learned on this retreat. But I thought first, let me just read a little bit from from this book that was one of the topics of study. It's a commentary on Prajnaparamita. So we have the Heart Sutra. This is, without going into too much detail about what it is, it's a long commentary on the kind of stages and paths of realization of Buddhahood according to Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And it's long. This is one of three volumes, so it's a long commentary. But the translator and commentator here, Karl Brunholzl, was the one who taught this. You know of him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he's an amazing character.
I saw him with Hannah Children.
Oh.
He came two summers ago, maybe?
Mm.
Meditated right there, and then we also did yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Chairs.
And
sat with Pema.
Mm. He's a great teacher and a translator and scholar. It was hard to fathom how his mind worked. both reading this and listening to him just roll this Dharma stuff out in this flow of eloquence,
and he's funny too.
He is funny. You wouldn't guess from maybe from reading this kind of book, but he is. And you know, putting together this book, I think took him like 6 or 7 years. I think full time writing, translating many different commentaries, and so on. But the introduction he writes himself just about study in general. So this is the part I found this, these are strong words, but encouraging to me. And it's, you know, maybe a little different perspective than what we usually, how we usually hear things. This wasn't really a meditation retreat. This was just like a study retreat, a little bit of meditation, but really like, set up like a college sort of format with many classes throughout the day and then homework assignments and discussion groups and staying up late at night trying to do the reading and so on. Interesting kind of format. And about 70 people or so immersed in these, what I consider very difficult texts. But the interesting thing is that they're practitioners. These were not like university students trying to get a degree or something. They're practitioners, but trying to really understand the view and direction of practice in the Tibetan tradition, but these are all universal Indian Mahayana texts that are being taught. And also this is in the context of what is Tibetan lineage that's would be considered, I would say, similar to Zen, in that we would call it like a sudden school. Zen is known as the sudden school, meaning like it's not like a long gradual approach. It's like clear, awake mind is available any moment, like right now, always. And yet, of course, every path has a gradual element too. The unfolding of that and deepening of that is gradual. So that's a kind of uniting of sudden, or maybe sudden's not quite the right word, but maybe imminent and gradual. So this is also coming from that perspective, but this text is kind of about the, well, in a way I would say integration of sudden and gradual also, but he's emphasizing this gradual approach here. And he's, you know, someone who's been in the American practice realm for a long time, and so this is his take on things. He says, many people seem to like just hearing and being inspired by the highest and most profound Buddhist teachings, similar to being touched by some masterfully played piece of music or an award-winning movie, and then move on. So you might see these. And these are strong words to me. I took them as something to examine for myself, but I also offer it to you. Because I think sometimes I approach Dharma in this way. Just give me like a shot of the ultimate. And that'll do for this lifetime. And then, of course, the next day I want another. I think it's this kind of instant approach of like modern American culture that he's talking about. In this way, there's no follow-up on such initial inspirations and no opportunity to let these teachings sink in and thus turn them into a readily accessible experiential part of one's mind. In this way, such teachings may become more like an entertaining show, maybe recorded in a book or on a tape on one's shelf, or just something one has heard. If asked about their contents, apart from just recalling some vague, pleasant feelings while listening, many people are unable to repeat or retain even a single word. You might have that experience from Dharma talks. I know many people have told me that kind of thing, or I've asked people in the past, you know, if I miss a talk, what was the talk about? And, oh, it's so great, but I can't quite remember what it's about. It was great, though. And I've had that experience, too. Moreover, whatever they may have heard in such a way often becomes mixed with their own ideas and inclinations, which have little to do with the profound, thorough, and undistorted understanding of the Buddha's essential messages. Even people who've been Buddhists for decades and have heard hundreds of Dharma teachings or read many books surprisingly often show an amazing lack of active knowledge about even basic Buddhist principles. And I think this is sometimes too true. Because often in our way of teaching in Zen, it's a little bit haphazard. Like, it's just whatever the speaker kind of feels like bringing up any given evening. So it's hard to get the whole overall picture sometimes. If you stick around long enough, you often do. But it's kind of by default. But that was one thing I appreciate about this group. Was very methodical, and there's introductory courses and intermediate and advanced building on one another. Of course, what they call introductory, I took one of the introductory and I could barely keep up with what was going on there. The introductory are quite advanced in this particular mode of, you know, I think in their practice center they may be teaching a different way, but this is more like a study retreat. Anyway, it's interesting. I think we could go practice for a long time, but it's hard also when we're not talking about it and things like that, so we can hear stuff, but then if we have to put it into words, or somebody says, what's Buddhism really about anyway? We might be like, well, I don't know how I'd put it to you right now. The same people who have trouble saying what it's about have no problem with intensely studying for 10 or more years to become a surgeon, engineer, or psychotherapist, but seem to deny the need for applying the same seriousness and persistence to studying the Dharma. Who would dare to perform open-heart surgery after having just listened to some lectures on how to do this, and without having thoroughly familiarized oneself with every detail of the necessary techniques and procedures? But this is precisely the approach of many people when they think they can perform the most advanced Buddhist practices without a thorough grounding in the underlying view and an idea of the bigger picture into which such practices fit. And I think this may be especially true of Zen, where Zen is all about presenting the highest view, and in a way maybe the grounding foundation comes just by continuing, just by coming to sit again and again, and not understanding maybe what's being said or these most exalted sounding teachings, but just continuing to physically show up on the cushion and sit, and something starts to seep in. The words and our experience start to become more integrated naturally. I think it's a kind of intuitive, natural approach we have, which may be good. I don't know. He's being a little critical of that here, though, I think, just because this is his personal style. And then he talks about Edward Kanze, who is the translator of Prajnaparamita, all these different sutras, that was a big source for what he did here. And so other than Edward Kanze, nobody's really taken up Prajnaparamita sutras, especially the longer ones, in that depth. He was a professor at UC Berkeley in the, I think, 50s, 60s. I think Tenzin Roshi studied with him at Berkeley. Maybe practitioner, but mostly professor. But that was his life's work, is just studying and translating Prajnaparamita sutras. And there's a little story from Edward Kanze saying his students were always saying, well, can't you make this more applicable, and accessible to us? And make it more American and fit into Berkeley in the 60s or something. And he said various things, but he said he would remind his listeners that it's not so much a matter of the Dharma adjusting itself to become adaptable to Americans, but of Americans changing and transforming themselves sufficiently to become acceptable to the Buddha. So I think we often talk about adapting our teaching, making it accessible to modern America, and I think this is important, and he says so too, and I think he would agree with that, but we have to watch this tendency to try to make it fit our current understanding very nicely and neatly so that it doesn't disturb us. I think when Dharma is really working well, it kind of disturbs us. I think that's when it's functioning most efficiently. It's kind of disturbing. Prajnaparamita is quite disturbing. If you really take in the words of the Heart Sutra, it's disturbing, right? There's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. We can just read it, but if we really take that in, that's disturbing, I think. Of course, this doesn't apply to just America, but also called modern societies, with buzzwords such as modernizing or westernizing Buddhism, in parentheses, whatever that means, because what does it mean actually? Getting to the essence, avoiding cultural trappings, working with emotions, or it needs to be immediately relevant to my life and my problems. All these in quotes. The preliminaries are skipped and one jumps to the highest teachings right away. Sometimes. More often than not, ending up in just happily superimposing one's own cultural biases onto the Buddha's teachings and then pretending to have found something culturally neutral or modern. It seems necessary, however, to take a closer look at, become aware of, and question one's own hang-ups too, which are not at all any better than those of other cultures. Also, the question is why one needs teachers and teachings if one just follows what one likes anyway. And then he says, to be sure, he's not advocating some kind of fundamentalism or strict conservatism, having to study the whole Buddhist canon or imitating Asian forms and so on. I'm all for adapting the Buddha's teaching to the present time, cult, society, culture, and problems, as has always happened in Buddhism. But there's much more that's needed to do than just following whatever's in the latest spiritual fashion. In its long history, Buddhism never succumbed to the idea of spiritual fast food, but usually always spoke from a long-term perspective. First, we need to be well informed about the Buddha's teachings in a comprehensive way before we can decide what their indispensable contents as opposed to external cultural forms are, and not just look for what we can get rid of if we don't like it or don't see its significance right away. So, he goes on like this for a while in the introduction, and then he presents this very kind of classical thing, and I think he tries to make the translation as accessible as possible for such type of teachings. So that's just something to reflect on that I think about often is as Buddha Dharma comes still very newly to this country. We might think, oh, it's been around a long time. It's like 50 years or so. It's like there's Zen centers in every town. But it's still in the scheme of history of Buddha Dharma through all these countries, it's very, very new, right? We're just trying to find our way. And I think one of the big questions is how do we adapt it, make it accessible, and yet keep it really authentic? Big challenge, I think, for all of us, right? We're the generation, I think, all of us in the next 100 years or so are the ones who are have to do this work. I mean, forever, actually, but I think this first century or so. It's a long thing. I think Buddha Dharma is here in this country for as long as this country will exist. I trust that. Hopefully, eons. We don't know. This country might not exist for more than another century. But I think as long as it's here, the teachings and practices of the Buddhas and ancestors will be helping us. So, with that background, let me speak a little of some of the traditional teachings of Buddha Dharma. One thing that was taught in this retreat, among many other things, a couple of different texts, were bringing up Buddha nature. And this is a big topic that we could get into in depth over time. And I don't think I've spoken about it much at all in the past, so just to introduce this idea of Buddha nature, it's a really wonderful concept and reality, particularly of the Mahayana, of the Great Vehicle, and it doesn't exist in the early Buddhist teachings. So sometimes Buddha's teachings are said to be taught in the three turnings of the Dharma wheel. Has anyone heard of that? The three turnings of the Dharma wheel. The Buddha himself says this occasionally in the sutras. So the first turning of the Dharma wheel is setting in motion the wheel of Dharma in the deer park at Isipatana near Varanasi, where we chant the sutra, supposedly the Buddha's first teaching ever. Once a week we chant here in the morning. So that was the first turning of the Dharma wheel in which the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. or as this creative translator likes to say, the four realities of the noble ones. You have to really look into, like, what does this actually mean? And a long discussion about what truth means versus reality, and also that the truths themselves are not noble so much as they're the truths realized by the noble ones, meaning the realized ones. So we have that one-page sutra that we chant, teaching of the Buddha, where the Buddha taught that there's suffering, and there's an origin of suffering, and there's a cessation of suffering, and there's a path leading to the cessation of suffering, the four truths or realities of the noble ones. And this is considered, from the later point of view, to be a kind of provisional teaching. One person had some kind of awakening, right, when hearing that, according to the sutra itself. And in fact, that kind of insight that the listener had when the Buddha was speaking those truths is said to be when that wheel of Dharma was set in motion. It wasn't actually just the Buddha's words, it's when somebody got it and it like liberated somebody to some extent. It's like now the wheel of Dharma is rolling, because that's what it's for, liberation from suffering. So then later, the Buddha taught the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, or the second Dharma wheel, on Vulture Peak in Rajagriha, where he taught, for example, the Heart Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra, also taught on Vulture Peak, would fit into this second turning. And all the Prajnaparamita sutras. And the second turning is about relinquishing all reference points. This is another translation of a specific term that this translator Kara uses, which I think is quite a wonderful phrase. Abandoning or relinquishing all reference points. So we have various reference points, like that's above and that's below and that's right and that's left and that's an angle over there, and this is the Zendo and that's outside and that's the street and this is Santa Cruz. Those are all like reference points. And the second turning is about abandoning all those. So actually fixating on or holding to any reference points. So these are the teachings of emptiness. No fixed characteristics of anything. And so this is goes beyond the first turning, where it's like there is suffering, there's a truth of suffering. This is saying, as the Heart Sutra says, no suffering, no origination, no stopping or cessation, no path. It relinquishes the reference points of the Four Noble Truths. So we could also say the first turning is making the mind workable by understanding these basic teachings about how suffering works. And more easy to understand too, right, than just relinquishing all reference points. But the second turning, by cutting through all conceptual elaborations, completely frees a practitioner from even fixating on the Four Noble Truths, even on the cessation of suffering as taught in the first Dharma wheel. So then we have the third turning of the Dharma wheel, taught in various places, like Sri Lanka in the Lankavatara Sutra, and celestial palaces, and every atom throughout the universe, and various other places. The third turning was taught. The wheel of Dharma was turned a third time. And this is talked about in different ways in different places. But it's usually said to be the definitive teaching. Definitive meaning like not provisional. And definitive sometimes is defined as making very fine and careful distinctions between what's true and false, for example. So we have in this sutra that we were studying last spring, the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra is one of the main sources where the Buddha talks about these three turnings. And he says, he talks about in the Deer Park at Isipatana, the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. And this was rare and marvelous and wondrous. Nobody had ever been able to teach this before, but there was still something beyond that teaching, some room for interpretation. It wasn't complete. So in the second turning of the Wheel of Dharma, for those inclined to practice the great vehicle, the Mahayana, the Buddha taught that all things are essenceless, without origin or destruction, fundamentally quiescent, and inherently nirvanic. Inherently nirvanic means like naturally in a state of peace. Everything is like that. All dharmas, all phenomena are naturally resting at peace, including us. Even though we might not feel that way, it's not so much a matter of how it feels, it's just that's the teaching of how the second turning is. But the Buddha taught this in a covert, implicit manner. Now, this was even more marvelous than the first turning, yet there was still something beyond the teaching of that time, still some room, it was still incomplete. Now, some people would say these three turnings were taught at different times, like chronologically, and some would say, well, they were actually all taught simultaneously. The Buddha could do that, and he would just teach them to different people with different inclinations at the same time. Now, this third wheel of Dharma, also in the great vehicle, the Buddha openly and explicitly teaches the essences of all things, but makes good differentiations. And this is most marvelous. There's nothing beyond it. No more room for doubt. This is the definitive teaching in which controversy has no foothold. And there's some metaphors for how the definitive teaching relates to the provisional teachings. How you could apply this definitive teaching, which we'll talk about a little bit more also, like how that it permeates all the first and the second wheel teachings. Just as the background of a painting is the same throughout the work of the painting, whatever colors are used, the background of the painting is the same. And it furthermore highlights the details of the painting, the background, and it makes the paintwork clear. In the same way, this definitive teaching of essencelessness permeates all the sutras of incomplete and provisional meaning with one taste, the same in every case, and also makes the provisional teachings in those sutras clear. You get a sense for that? There's like the background of a painting is the same throughout. So you could apply this definitive teaching of essencelessness of no fixed reference points you could apply to the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And this third turning is more than just no reference points. That's the second, right? So the definitive is taught in different ways. What is this third turning of the Dharma wheel? How could you go beyond no fixed reference points? So it's sometimes taught to be the actual experience of just resting in the union of clear awareness and no fixed reference points. Clarity and emptiness interfused. Because just no fixed reference points is like there's nothing left at all. So the third turning kind of brings back something. It brings back this clear, bright luminosity that's present all the time in this directly experientiable way. It's like our life manifesting as clarity and awareness. Like, this is not nothing, right? Obviously, this is not nothing. Even if we can see that there isn't really any fixed reference points, that our mind is actually constructing right and left and up and down and Santa Cruz and the street and the country and books and floors and all these things are mental constructions and imputations. Still, there's this. Isn't there this? Now, Zen could be said to be based on all three turnings, but I think there's some connection between this third turning and Zen. Sometimes it's said also that the second turning is for completely clarifying the view of reality in a conceptual way. This is like the work of Nagarjuna. We just finished this class. Nagarjuna, logical reasonings that from a conceptual viewpoint completely, if you know, carried through to the end, they leave nothing to hold on to. The conceptual mind can completely lose its foothold through these second turning teachings. Nagarjuna would generally be considered a second turning teaching. Refining and clarifying the meaning of Prajnaparamita through careful examination. So if the second turning is for completely clarifying the view of nothing to hold on to, the third turning is for actually just resting in this clear, open, naturally present awareness. So in a way, it's beyond reasoning. It's kind of seems kind of hard because the first two are so nicely laid out and there's so much to say about them and show how they work. If we can really see how the Four Noble Truths work in that first turning, and then we can see, it's a little more difficult to see, but we, through the help of Nagarjuna in particular, we can see how there really aren't any fixed reference points. We can come to understand that. But this third turning, it's going to be very hard to, you know, logically prove this awareness. It's just the way it is. And this unity of clear awareness and emptiness is also sometimes called Buddha nature. So in this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra, for example, it never brings up this term Buddha nature, but even though it brings up the third turning, and it says that this is a third turning sutra. In other sutras, the third turning is equated with the Buddha's teaching of Buddha nature. Buddha nature, or also called the heart of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is the thus come one. The Buddha often referred to himself as the Tathagata. So this is the Buddha's heart. It's the definitive meaning of Buddha's teachings. And in a simple way to put it, what is this Buddha nature? It's just clear, empty awareness. And the Buddha nature is taught as an encouragement, because all beings, well, as taught in the Parinirvana Sutra, all sentient beings always possess Buddha nature, always have Buddha nature. And this is what enables everyone to fully realize and manifest as a Buddha, as a completely unobscured Buddha. So there's a lot to say about Buddha nature from different perspectives, but it's often presented as like we all have Buddha nature, but it's obscured by our confusion. For example, we have all these reference points. Like, we really think that that's up and that's down. That would be considered like an obscuration of Buddha nature. That's kind of strange, huh? The fact that we think that that's up and that's down is, and we actually feel like that's kind of true. And somebody says, is that really true? We can start to see, well, maybe not. I can see how it's just my idea that says that's up and that's down. And if I were standing on the roof, the ceiling would be down instead of up. So it's all a matter of reference points depending on where I'm standing. So there aren't fixed reference points that are all dependent on, you know, where this mind is in relation to them. But still, we still, in the end, really feel as if that's up and that's down. And that confidence, you could say, that that's up and that's down, and this really is Santa Cruz, I think we tend to be quite confident that that's so, that that's an obscuration of Buddha nature that's here right now, always. That's the good news, that it's here always, imminently right now. And the kind of difficult thing is it's obscured by our fixation on reference points. And then for a fully awakened Buddha, basically that is the end of all fixation of reference points and more, but that's how Buddha is traditionally defined. So Buddha nature has kind of come to fruition. So there's different models about this Buddha nature. Some would see it as in one of these classes, it was presented like these three kind of traditional ways of looking at how Buddha nature becomes Buddha, comes to the fruition of a fully realized Buddha. So one is the production model, which is like a seed producing a fruit, for example. Like Buddha nature is like this seed inside of us, invisible seed of Buddhahood that gradually grows and produces a fully unobstructed Buddha. That's one model. Basically we're talking about the relationship between Buddha nature and fully realized Buddha. Then there's the that's a production model. Then there's the transformation model, you could say, where Buddha nature doesn't like grow into a Buddha. It's already here as a Buddha, but it's like it's obstructed by all these impurities, we sometimes say, of basically like fixed reference points, and by gradually purifying these illusions, really. That's what we mean by purifying in Dharma, usually is seeing through illusions. For example, that that's up and that's down. So this is a transformation of the already complete Buddha nature into a fully purified Buddha that has no more illusory obstructions blocking it. So that might sound a little better than the production model, right, the transformation model. But then there's a third model we could call a disclosure model. And that's like that there's not even some impure thing to be transformed into a pure thing. It's just a matter of disclosing this already always completely pure Buddha nature. Disclosing it, revealing it, we could also say. So not only does it something small have to grow into something big, or something impure has to be transformed into something pure, but Buddha nature is fully present right now. It's just a matter of disclosing it. So in old tradition, it's often presented in those ways. Disclosure maybe might sound like the best to us. I think of those three. It sounds, I'd rather go with that because it's so imminent, right? It's just a matter of you know, this is fully possible. We don't have to purify anything in that sense of like something is impure that has to be purified. It just has to be fully revealed. So then we have to wrap it up with our Soto Zen tradition of Dogen Zenji, who has a very beautiful essay on Buddha nature called Buddha Nature. And which I hope to fully explore with you all at some point. It's very, very long. So we could spend a whole year, I think, just looking at this. Considered to be one of the most important fascicles of the Shobo Genzo by Dogen freaks throughout space and time. See, he just begins quoting the Parinirvana Sutra, which is one of the classic statements about Buddha nature. That remember that sutra that says, all sentient beings without exception have Buddha nature. So Dogen twists that, or he rereads it a little bit. And this is partly his use of language, but he adds in a couple characters into the sutra. He feels like he can do that. He can actually just like, kind of like say, the Nirvana Sutra says this, and then kind of rewrite it with his own little twist. So it's basically something like, all sentient beings in their whole being, without exception, are Buddha nature. Instead of saying, all sentient beings have Buddha nature, he first adds in this, all sentient beings, whole being. He adds in whole being. All, so it's a kind of as an adjective maybe for all sentient beings. All sentient beings, you know, seen as one whole being, are, or is, you could even say, Buddha nature. So it's no longer a question of somebody having something, it's problematic, but all beings, whole being, is itself Buddha nature, which I think is quite similar to this disclosure model of Buddha nature, but maybe even goes a step further, that we may be able to open to that there's not even anything to disclose. There's actually nothing blocking or obstructing this Buddha nature at all. But that's a little bit a simple way to say it, because he goes on for about 30 pages to talk about Buddha nature. But there are some teachings, three turnings of the Dharma wheel taught by the Buddha. And you can see, if you go home and somebody says, what was the Dharma talk about? And you say, oh, is it about the three turnings of the Dharma wheel? Will you remember them? This is a great kind of framework for looking at a lot of Buddhist teachings through the first turning of provisional teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and we could put in all these other things, the five skandhas and all these elements of Abhidharma and so on that make up a human, breaking things down into elements. And then the second turning, where there aren't even any elements. We've broken everything down into the elements, but the elements have no fixed reference points. There's nothing to get a hold of. And then the third turning is just put all that aside and just rest right here, now, clear, empty, aware, no reference points to refute, no reference points to hold on to, nothing to negate or posit, the heart of the Tathagata. If you have any questions or comments about this, please feel free to bring them up at tea, because it's about time to stop. Oh, this book of is called Gone Beyond, and just to mention a little anecdote of his humor. At the, you know, he puts little poems and things at the very, on the kind of forward title page, is kind of like the opening page. He quotes William Shakespeare saying, "Much ado about nothing." And he calls them three bricks. You can build a house out of them. Much ado about nothing. So it's volume one of three on, it says the Prajnaparamita Sutras, but it's basically a translation of the Ornament of Clear Realization, which is a treatise by Maitreya or Asanga, the founder of Mind Only, founder of Yogacara Buddhism in ancient India. Did this commentary on particularly not so much emphasizing emptiness, but more about the stages of the paths of Prajnaparamita. But emptiness is woven in. So as he's, Carl, we get so into these details, he'd periodically say, "And by the way, none of this is really happening." And then he'd go back into the text. And this is the Sasandhimocana Sutra, called Buddhist Yoga, the scripture on unlocking the mysteries. And this is Dogen's Jobo Genzo, which has a very nice translation of Buddha nature with great footnotes. It's also, of course, in all translations of the Jobo Genzo. May all sentient beings immediately disclose and reveal their imminent heart of Buddha, while at the same time entering the first, second, and third turning of Dharma wheel over and over again until they all roll into one for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusion possible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.